Environment and Land Use. Good morning, committee. And we have on the schedule today three Senate bills, which will, at this point, complete our list of Senate bills that we have. And we also have a couple of House bills to work on, and we're going to start off in that area with opening a work session on 2468. Committee, it's been a while since we heard this, and if the Mr. Kelly will refresh our memories, we have some amendments to look at, and Representative Jensen will explain those amendments.
Yes, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2468 was heard by this committee on February 13th. The amendment you have before you are dash 4 amendments to House Bill 2468. They replace the original measure.
I don't have dash 4 amendments. Are they in today's file?
They should be in today's file. And dash 4 amendments, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, are a culmination of work between the good representative on the witness stand, the governor's office, and the state agency responsible for implementing this act, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. And we'll say, Representative, do you have the amendments now?
Yeah, I somehow had 3220 in mine rather than 2468. Okay. And trading them in. I've traded them in.
Representative Jensen, good morning.
Good morning. I'm puzzled with the representative's copy of 3220. We'd be happy to have him read over them quickly and come down to the other committee.
No, I would be happy to do that. 500 cubic feet flow doesn't seem adequate to me.
We've heard that. We're not necessarily sympathetic with it, but be that. Good morning, Mr. Chair, and I would like to thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for your indulgence and patience on this bill. The bills that you have that you will quite quickly recognize as the proverbial, as we refer to them, gut and stuff. This is a completely different bill, I think, than we had before. And it's a bill that we have worked very hard with the Department of Fish and Wildlife and the governor's office to bring about. It's an amendment basically to the Endangered Species Act, and before some of you bristle a little too much at the representative, let me point out that this is the representative worked at the request of the Department of Fish and Wildlife to try to bring this bill about for you. And for the record, I'm sorry, I'm State Representative Bob Jensen from Pendleton, and my district occupies most of Umatilla County. It includes the metropolitan areas of Pendleton and Hermiston and the smaller cities surrounding those two communities. House Bill 2468 with the dash 4 amendments is provided for your consideration to allow the Fish and Wildlife Department some additional tools in their toolbox in order to be able to effectively and efficiently manage the resource that they are empowered by statute to manage, or the resources that they are empowered by statute to manage. The representative is not going to take your time in explaining the details of this bill. We have the agency here, and I believe that there's that the chair intends to call them. Given that intent, it would be repetitious for me to go over that material and then have them come up and go over it, and they probably, in many ways, are as familiar or more familiar with it than I am. So I'm going to leave that to the department and really simply try to impress upon the members of the committee that I have worked with them. I am in concurrence with all but one section of this. I have another bill that I am going to be introducing that probably will wind up in the same place we are, that will address that particular section. So, given my ability to be able to do that and have a hearing on that issue, I am generally in 100% concurrence with the department and with the governor's office on this. Now, just quickly, I would point out to members of the committee that the department has, in some ways, a very difficult chore. There are some endangered species that are on the Oregon Endangered Species Act that should be removed from the listing in the on the Endangered Species Act. Specifically, a gray whale, which has been removed from the Federal Endangered Species Act, but the department has some difficulty getting the gray whale off of the Oregon Endangered Species Act. And I think you've heard some of this story before, but then the Alaskan Aleutian goose that is on the Oregon Endangered Species Act that's been removed from the Federal Endangered Species Act, but the department is unable under the existing law to be able to remove it from Oregon's Endangered Species Act, even though there is nothing that we can do about the provision, nothing we can do about that provision. So in order to clean up the ESA, that's one of the purposes for this. There's another issue that was the representative's specific concern in the Federal Endangered Species Act. There is what is referred to as a God Squad. A God Squad that can remove a species from the federal listing, not because of biological conditions, but for other reasons. That tool we do not have, and I'm not even suggesting that we have a species right now that would necessarily apply to, but it would seem important for us to model as much as we can the federal act here, and so we have generally added in this change in the Endangered Species Act, Oregon's Endangered Species Act, the idea of a God Squad. And fundamentally what this is, if something happens that removes our ability as a state to be able to do anything as far as recovery of the species, that somebody ought to have the ability to say, this is outside of our hands. It's outside of our control. So to spend money and energy and resources then that would come with a continued listing, we ought to be able to get those off of the list. And I'll let the department explain to you, exactly how, if you're interested in that question, that is going to take place. I think, for example, maybe a natural disaster, eliminates or makes it impossible for a species to continue to live and exist in the state of Oregon. We're fortunate, if I can kind of digress with this, that they didn't have the Endangered Species Act many millions of years ago when the dinosaurs were here. Had we had the Endangered Species Act then, without the advent of a God Squad, or without a God Squad to have had the ability to say, this is outside of our control, nature has decreed there will be no more dinosaurs, therefore, we'd still be have the dinosaur listed. And that would seem, and I apologize for the simplicity of perhaps that illustration, but such events do happen, and we, I think, need to be prepared in our Endangered Species Act to deal with them. But I would close with that, and if there are any questions that I can answer for you, I would be happy to, and if I can't answer them, with your permission, Mr. Chair, I'll reach around and try to grab Roy Elliker and bring him up to the podium to be able to answer them for me.
We're going to bring both Roy and Jim Myron from the governor's office up in just a moment. So thank you, Representative. I appreciate that. We also have Senator Farioli with us, so I'm going to briefly recess the work session on 2468 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 94A and invite Senator Farioli to come forward for his testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the
Senate. Will you be available, Bob, or do you
have a question?
Okay, thank you.
Back down,
thank you. Good morning,
sir. For the consideration, I appreciate it. I'm playing hooky from the judiciary, and they're down to a very slender quorum. So I appreciate the fact that you're allowing me to speak. Ted Farioli, District 30, here on Senate Bill 94. Members of the committee, Mr. Chairman, the bill that you have before you is a relatively simple bill. It's designed to help clarify when two interlocking statutes intersect, and they're both clocks. The right now, the jurisdictions have 120 days for final application, for final determination, for final decision making on an application under our current land use system. There's another clock, and that is a 180 days, and that is a clock that is connected with the completeness of an application, both are in statute. The confusion arises when an application arrives at a city planning desk and it cannot be determined whether or not the application is complete for all purposes. So applicants can get into a land called the limbo of the lost. They don't have a completed application. And then they go in, they talk to people, well, you need this, you need that, you need the other thing. And the clock doesn't start until the application is deemed to be complete. So what we have done with Senate Bill 94, with the cooperation of both the City of Portland and the City of Eugene, which think that this is a great new clarification in how these clocks work, is we produced the Engross version of Senate Bill 94, which does a couple of things that I think are very simple. It basically allows the city to determine when the 120-day clock begins and how to make that timeline work for the applicant and for the city. For instance, the first change that we made in the statute that's included in the Engross version of Senate Bill 94, it allows the jurisdiction to determine that the application is complete. And that's sort of the beginning phase of the clock. When all information has been provided, when some of the information has been provided and the applicant agrees to submit the missing information, or when the applicant refuses in writing to submit requested documents, those things can be used with these changes in Senate Bill 94 to determine that, in fact, the 120-day clock has started. The other change would allow the...
May I interrupt you?
Representative? Item B doesn't say what you just said. You just said some of the information is available and the applicant agrees that they will provide the rest. Item B says, and they say they will provide no more.
Mr. Chair, to Mr. Greenlee, item B, what are we referring to?
I'm looking on the engrossed bill,
yes.
Line 19. The applicant my assumption is if the applicant says they'll provide missing data, then that keeps the clock running. This is when the applicant says, no, I'm not going to do it.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenlee, I think you have to parse the sentence. Some of the missing information and written notice from the application that no other information will be provided. So essentially, the clarification here is that there's an interaction, iterative process between the applicant and the jurisdiction. And the attempt is, hey, let's get this application complete. Do we agree that all the missing information will be provided, or do we agree that you're not going to give us anymore?
That's
and start the clock. The second issue, of course, is that there is no time certain at present where a jurisdiction can finally decide that an application has sort of died. This bill before us would allow the jurisdiction to allow an application to expire after 180 days when the applicant has not provided the information requested refuses to communicate that he will or will not provide the missing information in writing and hasn't established any kind of a time certain for providing the missing information. So jurisdictions shouldn't be required to keep open an application for an interminable period of time. So what we're trying to do is balance the equities with Senate Bill 94. We're starting a clock at a time certain that people can agree to. We're allowing the jurisdiction to close an application that just drags on interminably. And we've added one more provision, and that is that we are allowing the applicant to make extension requests to a total limit of 245 days. That is the sum total of the bill. It has the support of the City of Eugene and the City of Portland. They believe that it will clarify when applications are complete, when the 120-day period begins, allows them a backdoor at the 181st day if they simply can't get the information that they need from a recalcitrant applicant, also provides the 240-day maximum period of additional time for consideration when requested by the applicant. So I think it's one of those little housekeeping bills. It's my attempt at bridge building with the urban jurisdictions that need help in their land use process, and I hope you look favorably upon it, Mr. Chairman.
Any questions of the Senator? Seeing none, thank you, Senator. We appreciate your attendance.
And, Mr. Chairman, I appreciate your consideration in getting me in, interrupting the previous hearing. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you,
I need it in judiciary.
We shall recess the public hearing on Senate Bill 94A and reopen the...
Yes. Would you like to work this bill?
We could if the committee is comfortable.
Is the city? The city was here a moment ago. Were they going to?
All right. Well, we'll reopen. We'll reopen the public hearing on Senate Bill 94A, and have the cities come forward. I don't have a sign-up sheet yet. On. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Everyone, by the way, committee, who's speaking is in favor of this bill. If you
move fast, just say yes.
Good morning.
Good morning, Representative Gerard, members of the committee. I am Douglas Hardy with the City of Portland, Bureau of Development Services. With me is Bob Clay, Chief Planner with the Portland Bureau of Planning. As Senator Perioli, I think, eloquently explained what the bill is, it's relatively simple in terms of clarifying two of the clocks, what we call clocks in the land use, Oregon land use process. One is the 180-day clock that is given to applicants to complete an application. And once an application is deemed complete, then the 120-day clock begins, and that's the time frame that the city has to make a final decision. And basically, the bill proposes three things. The first, again, is to clarify when the application becomes complete, and therefore then the 120-day clock starts. And currently, state law has said that if any of the missing information is provided by the applicant, the 120-day clock starts. And historically, that creates some unclarity on basically all parties, both for the city and for the applicant, in terms of, you know, has my 120-day clock started? So what the bill does is basically indicate that the clock, 120-day clock, would start when all of the requested information has been provided, or when the applicant indicates in writing that only some of the missing info will be provided, or in fact that none of the info will be provided. Secondly, the bill would allow incomplete applications that have been put on effectively indefinite hold at the request of the applicant to gracefully expire. Currently, as Senator Farioli indicated, there's no time frame in state law that basically would require an applicant to respond to any missing info. And again, what the bill proposes is that the applicant becomes void on the 181st day after it was first submitted if the applicant has been notified that there is missing info and has not submitted all of that info, or again has not submitted in writing indication that they wouldn't submit any or all of that info. So again, it's just clarifying and putting in writing so that everybody's working from the same page. And lastly, what the bill proposes is that the applicant can extend the 120-day review period up to 245 days. And therefore, the 245 days added to the 120 days that the applicant already gets basically ensures that the land use review would be completed within a one-year period. And so basically what the bill does is improve the certainty, basically, again, for all parties involved, the applicant and for the city, while still giving applicants ample time to complete the necessary application. And we ask for your support for the bill and are available for any questions that you may have.
This committee's in a little bit of shock and awe. We don't get too many bills where we don't have anybody against any of that.
Mr. Chair, could I...
Representative Greenwood.
I just want to ask a clarifying question because of what Senator Farioli said.
Right.
If you ask for information and the applicant says they will provide that information, that does not start the clock. Is that correct?
Right. Basically, the applicant has the opportunity. We're giving through the bill the applicant three options. Either they can say, no, they don't want to provide any of the info, and that will start the clock. Or they can provide some of the info and indicate in writing that they will not provide the remainder of the info. And again, that would start the clock. And thirdly, the applicant could say, I don't want to provide any of the info. And at that point, we would start the clock.
But the fourth case is...
Representative?
Excuse me, may I?
We're already getting out of the rules here. Your responses are supposed to come through the chair, and then the representative will respond
through the chair.
And the representative should request a follow-up question.
I would like to request a follow-up question.
Follow-up question.
Thank you very much. I'm learning. I'm talking about the fourth category, and I just want to put on the record so we don't get it confused on the legislative intent here. The fourth possibility is you ask for some information, the applicant says, yes, I will provide that information. That does not start the clock. Is that right? I mean, there's nothing in here that says that that does start the clock.
Right. Chair Gregg, Representative Greenwood.
Thank you. You got it.
We all learned.
Well, you're right to a degree. Number one, the applicant does have 180 days within that completeness period to provide all the info. The city will provide the letter to the applicant within 30 days of submitting that we need this info. So the applicant has from, again, 180 days to say, well, do I want to submit all of the info or only some of the info? And so basically it is up to the applicant. If they want to provide only some of the info and maybe providing some at a later point, they can either delay in terms of submitting the requested info up to 180 days, or alternatively, they could even say, okay, we do want the 120-day clock started and provide the info at that point within the 120-day clock. And again, because we're allowing the applicant to extend the 120-day clock by, 245 days, we've worked in adequate time for the applicant still to provide more info.
Well, this bill is to clear up ambiguity, and I just want to make clear, and it's only because of what was said on the record, I want to make clear
that circumstance four, it does not automatically start the clock. I mean, and I don't suppose it matters that we have an answer here, but that I want to put on the record that I that there is nothing in here that says anything about that fourth condition.
Ms. Kafori, would you like to respond to that?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Marge Kafori, representing the City of Portland. I think what your question is, the question for Representative Greenlick, is if an applicant says he is going to submit information, when he says that, does the clock start? The answer is no.
That's
the clock starts at 180 days when he submits. He
or,
has 180 days.
Or when he meets one of these other three conditions.
Correct. That's correct.
Thank you, sir. Correct.
Would you like to
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you very much. I would like to add that we introduced this bill in the Senate, sponsored by Senator Farioli, and after the original bill was introduced and before the bill was heard, we spent a lot of time with John Chandler and with the League of Oregon Cities to work out some of the particularities of the bill. And when the bill was heard, we introduced the Dash 1 amendments, which clarified and resolved all of the issues that we had amongst us. So this is a consensus bill among the people that had an interest in it, and I just wanted to put that on the record. I also wanted to tell you that it passed the Senate on the 31st of March with a vote of 28 aye votes, one no, and one excused. So.
Any questions of Ms. Kafori? Thank you. Did we have another testifier from the City of Portland? Okay. Ms. Ludwig, would you like to report?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Linda Ludwig, representing League of Oregon Cities. Just briefly wanted to indicate our support for Senate Bill 94. We did work with the parties on the bill, and I think that it does provide some clarity to that clock starting process. Just the other piece of information, in the past, not all cities across the state have handled this the same way. And we think this would provide a little more certainty, perhaps, to more jurisdictions. Thank you.
Any questions of Ms. Ludwig? Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chandler?
A motion?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, John Chandler, legislative advocates here with the Oregon Building Industry Association. I just want to confirm what Ms. Kafori told you. We worked out differences, and I think that on the Senate side, have a much better bill in front of you. I commend it to you. I was a little concerned to hear previous testimony that the applicant became void on the 181st day. That struck me as a little harsh, presuming that application.
Depends who it is.
Yeah, quite so. We all have our list. But that still shouldn't be a matter of state law. That should be a local issue. Mr. Chairman, will that take a question?
Any questions of Mr. Chandler? Seeing none, thank you, John. Anyone else wish to testify on Senate Bill 94A? Okay, seeing none, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 94A. And open a work session on Senate Bill 94A. Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move Senate Bill 94A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Representative Rosenbaum has moved. Well, we all hope someday. Right? Representative Rosenbaum has moved Senate Bill 94A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Aye.
Representative Freeman.
Aye.
Representative Doyle.
Excused.
Representative Ackerman.
Aye.
Representative Zahner.
Excused.
Representative Richardson.
Aye.
Chair Garrard.
And the chair votes aye. Senate Bill 94A is moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and we will put it on the consent calendar. Thank you. And now those of you that have been patiently waiting, we will reopen the work session on House Bill 2468. And I'll ask Roy Elliker and to come forward. And Jim Myron, Jim, if you'd like to also come up. Committee, this is a very significant bill that we're looking at the moment. And the committee wants to take as much time as necessary to allow all of us to hear the ramifications of what this bill could do. So, and again, we're a little surprised that we're having all the agreements this morning. This is wonderful. So, good morning, gentlemen. Jim, would you like to start off?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Jim Myron with the Governor's Office, and I just would like to say that that the Governor's Office has been involved in the deliberations over the Dash 4 amendments that are before you today. We support those and believe that these proposed changes to the State Endangered Species Act are important and necessary, and would encourage your support of the bill as well. The department can get into the particulars if you have any particular questions.
Any questions for Mr. Myron? Seeing that, thank you.
Thank you
very much. Good morning, Roy. We haven't seen you here as much since we got rid of all the water stuff.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Roy Elliker. I'm the Deputy Director for the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife for Fish and Wildlife Programs. And on my right, Mr. Ron Anglin, our Wildlife Division Administrator, also the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. And I'd like to refer to a testimony we've just passed out to the committee, which outlines what these Dash 4 amendments do. First of all, Mr. Chair, let me state it's a great pleasure this morning to be here in this committee and be able to bring to you these amendments, which the agency has worked very diligently on, and in careful coordination with Representative Jensen in particular, the Governor's Office, and our agency. And we believe these Dash 4 amendments make the State Endangered Species Act a much more useful tool for the department, for the Fish and Wildlife Commission, and for the state. And let me get into some of the particulars and refer you to my testimony at this point. And I'll skip, frankly, right, because we have been here before testifying on the State Endangered Species Act and what it applies to and what it does. So in that first introductory paragraph, again, it focuses action on state-owned or state-leased land. And that is really the major focus of the state act. And of course, Mr. Chair, we have other testimony we've given, I think it was last month, about the act, what animals are on the act, and I'd like to get right to the amendments, if so, and if there's other questions in particular to the act, we can take those as well. But the first major change that we are proposing in these amendments is that it defines and clarifies the term take, which is to harm, capture, or kill species on the list, to expand the current language to include five major categories. It allows take in response to damage. It's defined in ORS 498.012. It allows take in response to human safety concerns. It allows also scientific take, incidental take, and take for necessary management actions. And I'll let Mr. Anglin get into some details if that was what the committee requests on those issues. Additionally, for clarity, we do some housekeeping on the current ESA and consolidate all those take provisions in one section of the Act. Second of all, and this is a major issue again for the department, is that it moves our state ESA into the world of what I like to refer to as recovery. In other words, the way the Act was written years ago was that it talked about conservation of the species, and that's always been a term in relation to the Act that was difficult sometimes to define, because what the federal Act goes towards and what everybody realizes what we're looking to do is when an animal's on the list, we're looking to recover the animal and get it off the list. That's what the list is about. So we have gone through and substituted recovery for conservation throughout the Act, and the fact that a recovery plan would now be required for each listed species. Next, an important point for Representative Jensen is that a federal action of a species that's listed on both the state and federal ESA would trigger within 90 days that the commission, the State Fish and Wildlife Commission, would be then required to make determine whether or not the species would stay on a state list. And there's been several examples of those that might apply to. For instance, Representative Jensen mentioned a great whale. Had this provision been in effect when the gray whale was federally delisted, within 90 days, our commission would have been required to review the status of the gray whale in Oregon and decide whether or not it should remain on the list or be removed. So this sets a definite time that the commission will review the species status here, and that's an important point for the department and for Representative Jensen. Next, the commission will be granted broader authority when considering removing a species from the Oregon ESA by allowing criteria of the same by allowing consideration of the same criteria using added species, and that's on, in particular, page 6, number 9. And what we did there, frankly, was, and in that section, it allows the commission to consider, when it's considering whether to add a species to the list, it now allows the commission to use the same criteria, which is more broad than just biological criteria currently for removal. It allows them to use the same broad criteria for removal of the species. So it makes much more consistent the commission's discussions and the commission's decision making on whether to add a species to the list or to remove a species from the list. It'll be now the same criteria for each decision, and the agency felt strongly that that is something that the commission had lacked before. We are locked into only biological criteria for removing a species from the list, and as we've talked about some of these other species, that made it very difficult for some species that frankly should not be on the list right now to be removed. So in summary, we feel that the passage of House Bill 2468 with the Dash 4 amendments will provide the Department and the Commission and the State of Oregon with a broader range of tools for recovering species, removing species from the Oregon ESA that should not be there for a number of reasons, and addressing damage and human safety concerns. And again, Mr. Chair, we appreciate the opportunity to provide these comments. We also have Mr. Martin Nugent sitting behind us, our kind of program leader and probably the most technical of the three ODFW folks here today, that can go into some fine tuning if you have those kind of questions as well. And with that, sir, I'll turn it back to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Richardson.
Mr. Ehlicker, I've read this and it looks fine. Everything looks fine. Is there anyone that's highly or actively against what you're proposing here?
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, because of the nature of these, in some ways, delicate negotiations back and forth, Representative Jensen, the governor's office, ourselves, we just barely completed these amendments in time for today's hearing. And to be fair, sir, most of the folks in the room today, a number of them have been very interested in how we've been working on this. Because we were working in a delicate situation, we were not at liberty to tell everybody where we were on different times. So I would say, Representative Richardson, that I'm not sure where the environmental community or the landowner community, such as the Cattlemen and Farm Bureau, are on these amendments. And to be fair, they've just seen them this morning.
Follow up?
Follow.
I have only one question. It's on page 3. We're deleting language which says, an incident taking permit or statement issued by a federal agency for a species shall be recognized by the state as a waiver of any state protection measure or requirements otherwise applicable. And so that language is being taken out. And so everything else looks fine to me. I'm just wondering if you could explain why is that being taken out?
Chair Garrard, members of the committee, for the record, Ron Anglin, Wildlife Division Administrator with ODFW. We felt that by including the new language defining take in bullet one in our bill statement, and then also with bullet three that would trigger commission review, that we would end up still having the same flexibility as what's in here. This is some of the consolidation of the take provisions into one section, and by putting all that in a take section, and it specifically defines incidental take as compared to the federal 4D rules, it actually broadens and gives us more flexibility than what the current language does.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to ask you about the change at the bottom of page 11, the new language talking about a good faith belief that persons are in danger. It seems like a pretty broad exception, and I'm wondering how you would evaluate. I mean, it seems like anybody could come along and assert that they believed that and
attack my spotted owl.
No, the swarm. They were being attacked by the swarm.
Chair Garrard, representing Representative Rosenbaum, this mirrors federal language, and what it's designed to do is that in an extreme case where it's typically explained is there's a human safety concern, somebody takes an animal and that is on a state or a federal list, that this in effect gives them some legal protection if they're taken to court, that if they can show there was a good faith effort there, that they would be provided some legal protections in a court proceeding.
My follow-up, Mr. Chair, but it just seems highly subjective. I mean, what would the criteria be for evaluating whether it was a valid threat?
Chair Girard, Representative Rosenbaum, it would depend on the species, on how it was investigated. If it was a federally listed species, then the federal government would be the ones that would go ahead and do the investigation through their law enforcement branch, through the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. If it was a state-only listed species, then it would be investigated by our Oregon State Police Division, and they would follow their typical criminal investigation type of responsibilities as associated with violation of the state ESA. And I can't go into a whole awful lot more detail than that because I'm not real familiar with how they would apply that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, if I might, again, we put that language in the state ESA because that existing language is in the federal ESA or very similar language to that, and I assume that, I don't know, frankly, and I don't think that we know as department, whether or not there's actual criteria that the federal government use on that issue. If there are, that might be something our commission might decide to put into rulemaking to adopt criteria for that. And again, it's probably pretty incident-specific when something like this occurs, when there's actually a take of an endangered species because someone was afraid for their personal safety. And that's about the best I could respond.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thanks, sir.
See any further questions at this point? We have a couple folks who have asked to testify, so we may have a couple more questions come up. Can I have Steve Cafori and Martin Taylor come forward?
Skiing, Steve?
We're not going to ask you about the arm, Steve.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Steve Cafori. You should have seen the other guy.
It was a saloon.
I had an argument with a bicycle in the street, and the bicycle in the street won, and my collarbone lost. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Stephen Cafori. I'm here today representing the Wildlife Society, which, as I've said before, is the wildlife biologist, professional, and scientific society. It's not an advocacy organization. We were involved in the last go-around on this bill, I guess about 8 years ago, on this issue of state ESA, and at that time we noted there were problems with it, and today I wanted to compliment the folks who have been working on this, Representative Jensen and the state agencies and the governor's office. It looks like they've cleaned up an enormous amount of things that were problems in the bill. We have been concerned specifically about the problem about recovery, that the Act did not talk about recovery, talked about conservation, which shouldn't be the goal. Recovery should be the goal. And there's concrete steps that are taken to ensure that we don't just keep species on endangered status forever and ever, and the problems that result from that. So we're very supportive of that. We just saw these amendments, as Mr. Ellicker said a few minutes ago, been reading through them, and I noticed even that in what the presentation has been, the summary from ODFW varies slightly from what the exact words were in the bill that you had, and I assume that's because people were putting this together at the last minute. Let me just mention a couple of comments I have, then I'd like to say that my folks who are the biologists and scientists have a chance to read this. I am a long, long way from being an expert on anything in the whole world. I know how the legislature works, but I certainly don't know much about biology, and I don't know about the details of species management. But I did want to say that in this, so I'd like to ask if we could have a data to look at it, and I think we could, in 24 hours, turnaround a review by my folks. I'm not asking for weeks or anything. On the bottom of this page, it says a commission would be granted broader authority when considering removing a species from the Oregon ESA by allowing the consideration of the same criteria used in adding species. This includes the species is secure outside the state of Oregon, social, economic, and cultural considerations. Well, the language exactly here is cultural, scientific, and commercial significance, which is slightly different. And this is and, not likely to be recovered. And although, by the way, I read it in here, it's an or, not likely to be recovered. And I think that's a pretty significant and versus or issue there. Also, I think it's a problem in the original bill. It's not just a problem in what they did. I think it ought to be taken care of. And that is on page 6 of the bill, line 29, the same sub-area we were talking about. It mentions this, one reason for delisting would be that the species is not of cultural, scientific, or commercial significance. I'm not sure what commercial, scientific significance means. I do know what ecological significance means. And it seems to me that that would be a more important word here. Does this critter have some role in the ecology that we're dealing with? I mean, that is a very important question when deciding whether or not we should list or delist a species. As I've said here before, also I don't know, besides not knowing what scientific means, cultural and commercial significance I think are extremely important considerations to take into account when deciding how to react to listing, but they shouldn't be criteria used in delisting or listing. Listing or delisting should be a simple question of, is the animal in danger? If it is in danger, it should be listed, because that's what the list is. It says, here's a list of things that are in danger. If we say, yeah, it's in danger, but we don't want it to be, that's a different question to be asked separately from the question of, is it in danger? People should be able to take a look at the list and say, what animals do we have in the state of Oregon that are in danger? If they're on this list, they should be endangered. If there's not an on this list, they shouldn't be. Question is, though, what are we going to do once they're on that list? That's a different issue. And I think we can take into account during the recovery plans and the rules that the ODFMW has, what we do with those. We may decide that a thing is threatened, but because it's secure outside the state, or because it doesn't have ecological significance or something else, we're not going to make full-fledged effort. We're not going to spend a lot of time and money. We'll put this on the bottom of the list of critters that we do protect. And if you'll notice earlier in the bill, I'd have to dig through to find it. It's a little difficult with one arm to dig through a bill. But it does say that when we take a look at what kind of actions we're going to take on these various critters, that we view these dangers and different qualifications, decide which ones we attack first and which ones we say we'll take care of those after we take the other ones first. That's the proper thing we should do when we get past the science and we look at cultural significance. We take a look at what we do, not whether it's endangered or not, whether it should be on the list. So that's my testimony, Mr. Chair.
I think that it is I know it's the intent of the chair to try to move this bill this morning. And we understand it. Parties haven't had an opportunity to look at it, but it's my feeling we don't move it out, this bill might not get moved at all. And I think it's that significant that I would hope that any changes that might be discussed could be done on the Senate side. Are you all right with that, Steve? Can you work with that?
Mr. Chair, I understand the process down here, and I understand your request and the necessity for that request. And if you would let me go take that to the Senate and say that Representative Girard needed to pass this out and that he wants us to take a look at it, he may like it exactly the way it is. I'm not saying you're going to suggest any changes. That would be beyond my scope of authority, but I would say that if you could allow me to say to the Senate that Representative Girard asked you to take a close look at it again, that would suit me just fine. Thank you.
Okay. You have that. And I'll leave the other arm alone.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, Martin.
Good morning, Representative Girard. Chair Girard, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Martin Taylor. I'm here representing the Sierra Club of Oregon this morning. It's funny, if you'd asked me that same question, I was sort of inclined to give you a different answer, but then I understood arms may be in danger, so I'm now reconsidering it. I guess I'm here to speak just a little bit to a bill that I've seen for a little less than an hour now, and I haven't had a chance to run through the real experts from my association at this point. And this really is a new bill. It's a gut and stuff. There's a lot of new stuff in here. So my first comment is just on process. It would be nice to have a little time to get feedback. And I say that in this context. I would, Sierra Club has no problem coming and being, alarmed and taking a hard line position in favor of the environment. And I kind of expected to be alarmed this morning. And to be honest, this looks pretty good. I mean, I think the work that ODFNW and the governor's office did on this shows something that is close. I think some of the questions that we have might be answerable, and even potentially small fixes could be made that could get us all the way there. And for us, the 24 hours or more might be the difference between fighting a bill on the floor and telling you that you've done work that we're comfortable with. And I'll just point at two places that I think maybe the question is more clarifying in nature than even necessarily opposition. The first is in Section 5, Sub 9, which I think is probably the place in this bill that is going to be potentially controversial for us. And it is the and or question. Someone can answer this question today.
Which page 6?
Page 6.
Line 23.
This might be an LC question or something that somebody here already has an answer to, but it essentially sets up in sub A, B, and C three things, and I need to know the relationship between those things to each other. The way to either remove or decide not to list would appear to be A, secure outside the state. The word or is removed, so I'm assuming that that means implicitly that the next thing is an and. That secure outside the state and that the species is not of cultural, scientific, or commercial significance in the state. And then there's deliberately inserted an or, so I'm assuming that A has to be true and either B or C have to be true, and C is not likely to be recovered. That's how I read it, but maybe a legislative council or the crafters of this bill would read it differently.
I don't think that's the way it's...
I need to know what that means, because there's a significant difference to us between saying if any of those three things are true, it can be delisted, or if all three of those things have to be true.
That's what it says.
Or two of the three.
And in the adding to the confusion is in the testimony provided to by ODFNW, they do mention on the back side of the page, they have a list that Stephen's already read for you, but on theirs it says and, as if all of those things must be true. And I read the bill differently than that. So this is one of those places where in a very short period of time we may be able to become very comfortable with the section, or at least we know why we're uncomfortable.
Time is one thing this committee doesn't have very much of.
Sure.
So I hope that you will get your concerns whenever you have... I've learned this through the public trying to get the public contracting bill through, that when you have significant legislation, which I believe this to be, that there are a lot of groups that suddenly have concerns, and certainly we want to address those concerns as rapidly as possible. So we do apologize for the time schedule that we're on, but we believe it's important.
Yeah, no, and clearly it's something that has a priority from the Speaker and from the Governor's Office and from the state agencies that administrate it. I just know that very few lawmakers have been involved in these discussions at this point, and interest groups on either side of this issue haven't either. So to the extent that this is a very important change to the state of Oregon, the process here is important. And there was one other that I wanted to mention, because it's not something that Mr. Tesfori brought up.
Could we ask the folks who negotiated this whether what they thought that it's clear to me it reads any of the three. I mean, I think that is the and if that isn't what was intended, then at least we can put on the record that's not what is intended here, and that would give it the ability to clear it up in the Senate in a faster.
Representative Doyle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess just Mr. Taylor's concern, I think when he speaks to his own legal counsel, he will have that concern alleviated, because it is, as Representative Green suggests, and I think that showing the intent of the committee as well as it's our intent that it's as Mr. Green or Representative Green has suggested. So,
well, I'm suggesting that won't clear up his concern. It will heighten his concern, but I think it clearly reads that way. I hope.
Well, we now have legislative counsel here, so if you want to go that direction.
Shame on.
I hope we do.
Oh. Hey.
Representative Doyle, would you propose the question to Mr. Shamoff and the attorney to attorney is...
Well, I guess, sure, Mr. Chair, because I guess I don't share Mr. Taylor's concern, but looking at page 6 of the dash 4 amendment to HB 2468, the question that Mr. Taylor had, on starting on line 28, the removal of or, the addition of the word or on line 30, and then how it relates with those three subsections, A, B, and C, does that mean that, I guess, the determination of species has to be all of those three, any of those three, or two of those three to satisfy the... I guess how the commission makes their decision that's stated in subsection 9 of the amendment.
Mr. Chair, Representative Doyle, Greg Chamoff, Legislative Council, any of the three.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, there was originally two, and it had an or between the two, and they added the third, and the or was moved. It's any of the three is what it reads.
Okay.
It's nice to hear our councilors.
Thank you, Councilor, very much.
Well, that's very helpful. I just have one more quick remark on a different issue, and that is in the
two councils we had here, we could have got three opinions.
Yeah.
I feel all of a sudden very important. on the first page under the section 2, the expansion of the uses of take, there's in line 18E, phrase that says necessary management of the species, and in seven other places in the bill the word management was exchanged for the word recovery, and I'm wondering if the necessary recovery of the species is an appropriate change to be consistent with the other places, or whether that's intended to be management. I just use these as illustrations of places where some brief discussions may be helpful to getting greater consensus on the bill, but I do understand your timelines, and the process will be what it's going to be, so I appreciate that.
Thank you. We have two other individuals who wish to speak. I don't know whether they're for or against, but I'm going to ask. Representative Richardson has another meeting he needs to get to, so I'm going to ask you to make your comments brief, if you would, either for or against.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Al Elkins, Oregon Hunters Association. We have some concerns, and we will work with the department and the governor's office on them between now and the Senate, see if we can get them worked out. So I'm all for moving the bill.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Greg Addington with the Oregon Farm Bureau. And similar to Mr. Elkins' comments, we appreciate the efforts of the governor's office, ODFW, and the good representative who's worked very hard on this. There is a problem out there. We think this goes a long way to helping solve that problem. There are things we would like to see maybe a little different as well, but fully willing to move the bill along and work on it later in the process. So.
Thank you, Greg.
For the record, Glenn Sunbrink with the Oregon Cattlemen's Association. We think this bill is an improvement and gives the needed flexibility to the commission to make those decisions that need to be made. We very quickly, and we'll also work on the Senate side on some of the things, but very quickly on page 7, line 21, there is a new, actually it starts on line 21, but it talks about, actually on line 27, the interim protection measures necessary to conserve and protect the species and its habitat. Now that's the first time that I've seen habitat brought into the Oregon Endangered Species Act. And so I wanted, and also, just so we know, that when I think there's a significant difference between conservation and management being replaced by the word recovery, and when you see the word shall, to mean that, to me, that means they must do these recovery, and recovery is more expensive than the rather ambiguous word management. I kind of see some dollar signs here. I am pleased that the governor's office and ODFW on page 11, line 28, where it talks about that we actually can protect ourselves against a threatened species. At least there's acknowledgement that we might be protecting a species, unnamed, that could harm people. And I'm pleased that they are doing that. One final thing, when Roy Elker spoke earlier, he said that if there's federal action on endangered species, then that can trigger something for the commission to take action. But actually, in the bill on page 7, it says remove. So if there's a species removed from the federal list, and my question here, and for the record so that they can consider this, is what if they just change the listing of the species from endangered down to threatened? And this says removed. And so I'd like to see, maybe on the other side we can change that to say if the federals take some action, maybe we can mirror that action so we don't have conflicting endangered species. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much for your testimony, Bill. Is there anyone else wishes to speak? Committee, it's obvious that there are some groups with some concerns in this, and I would hope that those groups would get together with Representative Jensen and Mr. Elliker and work this bill as it progresses through the system. But it is significant, and the chair would like to move this bill out of committee today and to allow those discussions to continue. Any comments from any member of the committee? Representative Greenland.
Sir, I'd like to comment. I will vote yes to move this out of the committee. It strikes me that it was a good job. It's not only probably, I mean, we haven't had much chance, I haven't had much chance to look at it, but it seems to me not only, it's probably better than the existing bill, it's a lot better than what I thought we might be facing in a bill. So I am happy to move it out and hope as we have a chance to look at it and problems emerge, we can deal with them in the Senate.
Representative Doyle.
Mr. Chair, since we're in work session,
yes, we are.
Can we just go ahead and move adoption of the task force?
We can.
I move adoption of the task force.
Representative Doyle has moved the dash four amendments. Representative Ackerman.
Well, I just wanted to say that with respect to the addition of the word habitat on page 7, I just wanted to make a record that I think that's similar to the language on lines 24 to 27, which are being amended out, which provide for guidelines regarding resource sites such as spawning beds, nest sites, resting colonies, or other sites. I think the word habitat is just identifies what has been was being taken out. I don't believe it's a new issue.
Thank you, Representative. We appreciate those comments. Is there any further discussion on the adoption of the dash four amendments to House Bill 2468? Anyone object to adoption of the dash four amendments to 2468? Seeing none, the dash fours are adopted to House Bill 2468. Representative Doyle.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2468 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Doyle has moved House Bill 2468 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Aye.
Representative Greenwood.
Aye.
Representative Doyle.
Aye.
Representative Ackerman.
Aye.
Representative
Zahner. Excused.
Representative Richardson?
Aye.
Chair Garrard?
Chair votes aye. House Bill 2468 is moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and Representative Jensen will be deemed the carrier. Thank you, committee. We appreciate being able to accommodate all the accommodations. We will...
Let's
go back and we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 251A. Kelly?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 251A applies provisions related to needed housing within an urban growth boundary to cities outside metropolitan service districts with populations of fewer than 25,000. This measure came out of the Senate on February 19th with a vote of 25 ayes, 0 nays, 1 excused, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Kelly. Bob Rindy?
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Bob Rindy with the Department of Land Conservation and Development. And this bill is a repair of really a mistake that was made last session, and I certainly have to take much of the blame of that. Last session, we had a long and a very good discussion about the kinds of steps that cities will, larger cities, take in amending their urban growth boundaries. I think the bill was 2976. Home builders, local governments, and our department, amongst others, were at the table for much of the session, and we all came to a consensus, a happy consensus, I believe, and moved forward. At the last minute, we had a quick discussion about whether that bill, what size of cities that bill would apply to, and we all agreed it should apply to cities over 25,000. What nobody noticed until sometime after the session was done was that the last-minute amendment that was made to take that step, for unexplained reasons, but I think accidentally, swept in a whole number of statutes, and not simply the 197-296, which was the subject of the bill and what we were all amending. The other statutes that were swept in are very important statutes. They have to do with jurisdictions' responsibility to provide needed housing. And this was a long discussion in the legislature in the early 1980s when most of these provisions were put in. They have to do with the whole definition of what needed housing is, and how cities provide for needed housing, including mainly affordable housing, manufactured housing, manufactured home, multifamily housing, and a series of other provisions. They have to do with farm worker housing, which we did last session also, and a lot of those kinds of provisions. So what we have done simply with this bill is try to put those back into effect for cities less than 25,000. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I don't think any city in seeing this intended to take advantage of it and back up from the provisions in their comprehensive plans to provide for those kinds of needed housing. But at the same time, we think you never know what kind of questions might arise in the future, and we think it would be prudent for the legislature to reenact or reapply these statutes to cities that are less than 25,000, and that's why we've brought this forward. Mr. Chandler is here. It was his bill that we were all working on last session, and he has endorsed this. I'll let him speak for himself. And with that, I have no further comments, and be happy to answer questions.
Thank you.
Yeah, I would like a clarifying question, if I may, sir. Without this bill, without this correction, cities of under 25,000 do not have to provide for the 20-year supply of housing inside their urban growth boundary. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, in terms of the statute, that may be the reading, yes. But the statute would not require LCDC to change its rules, and the 20-year supply is clearly embedded in LCDC rules. So that wouldn't change by itself. In other words, if this didn't pass, there's no requirement that LCDC take that requirement away.
Well, Mr. Chair, I may follow up. And I'm having trouble understanding. I mean, I don't see anything in here about manufactured housing or anything else.
If I could.
In terms of black or anything, all I see is a change on line 17 through 19, which talks about demonstrating it provides suitable buildable lands within the urban growth boundary for the 20-year goal, and I may be missing some other things that talk about manufactured housing or... The only change I see is the one I just asked you about.
Chair Garrard, Representative Greenlick, I apologize. I should have walked you through some of the detail here. The change that we are seeking is in line 11. It removes reference to that sweep of statutes from ORS 197-205 to ORS 197-314 and says instead, as we felt the bill last session was intended, that it's this section, i.e. ORS 197-296, that is the only section that would apply only to cities over 25,000. The black that you see in line 16 through 19, and I think you probably have seen this for dozens of bills this session, whenever legislative council sees an opportunity to correct what they see as language or grammar or errors in a statute, they make those changes. I don't think the black changes anything. It was simply legislative council volunteered or took this opportunity to make some of those corrections. But the real gist of the bill is in line 11.
I've got you. This is their updating of language stuff.
Yes.
Thank you.
Mr. Echo, Representative Ackerman.
Yes, may I ask if there is an inconsistency in reading Section 1, and this is the existing law, where it says that this language applies to cities that have a population of 25,000 or more, and its intent to apply the criteria to cities 25,000 or less. Don't we have an inconsistency leaving Section 1 as stated?
Again, what we're in, Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, ORS 197-296 is intended to apply to cities over 25,000. And what our amendment would do in section sub B of that section is clearly to make it consistent that that ORS 197-196 from henceforth excuses cities under 25,000 from those provisions. What our language does is take out those sweep of statutes in line 11 that would actually present an inconsistency, as you described, if they stay in, because they seem to imply that not only 196, but all those other statutes also only apply to cities over 25,000, and that was not the intent, but that I think is the effect, or at least it leaves that cloud over those other provisions.
Can one follow up, Mr. Chair?
Paul?
I think, though, my question was, and I think I see what you're doing by taking certain language out, but I still think it's inconsistent with the language of Section 1, which stays, lines 8 and 9, which applies the entire section to cities of 25,000 or more. I just raise that. Is that inconsistency? It's fixable if it is, but if it isn't, I think you've got a problem with statutory construction.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, John Chandler, Oregon Building Industry Association. Could I ask Griffin Ackerman a question to clarify? I'm not sure. I'm trying to see if I understand the question you're asking, Representative, and I don't think I do. Where's the inconsistency that you think?
On lines 7 and 8 of the existing law, where it says that this section applies to cities with a population of 25,000 or more, when I think you're intending to apply it to 25,000 or less.
Oh, Mr. Chairman, Reverend Ackerman, let me try to take a stab at this. This is it ain't poetry. I'll grant you. What we're trying to do, or this section of this ORS says, is that cities, the provisions regarding 20-year land supply, which Representative Greenlick's question, apply to, and the needed housing stuff in here, apply to cities over 25,000. That's in Section 1. In Section 1A, Section 1B, what we're trying to get it back to say is that the LCDC, the commission, can come up with factors to apply the requirements of Section 1A basically to jurisdictions under 25,000. So the first cut is big cities have to jump through some hoops. The commission can come up with reasons for why other cities smaller than 25,000 ought to be required to go through the same set of hoops. That's what I think the language is trying to say. And as Mr. Rindy indicated, the change we're asking for on line 11, which we absolutely support, is to fix something that shouldn't happen in the first place. But none of us caught, like he said. I think it was mostly his fault, but I'll take a little bit of the blame for that since it was my bill. The commission is upbringing. The commission can now, under this language, do what I just said. 25,000 up has to do these set of things. By rule, they can identify factors for jurisdictions under 25,000. But the important part for our purposes is to make sure that the smaller cities, as well as the larger ones, have to do the needed housing analysis, and that was where the manufactured housing and other sorts of requirements came in. That's what the language that we're deleting would have called into question, as to whether or not smaller cities had to have a balance of housing types, which we believe is very important.
I think you're trying to harmonize those, and I think that's important for the record. There may be an easier way to draft it, but I'm not going to make an issue of it at this point. I think I understand where they're coming from.
Mr. Chair. Representative Greenman.
I dragged out the statute so I can get a sense of what it says on 11. Are you saying right now cities under 25,000 are not required to perform under 197-298?
The question is directed to
to whoever can answer it,
Bob?
Including Randy sitting over there, if he has an answer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlich, the wording that we're deleting creates a lot of confusion about the applicability of that whole section of that whole suite of statutes from 295 to 314, including the one you're referencing. What we understand from our legal counsel is that it is a cloud. There are some arguments to be made that in spite of it, if we left it alone, you still have to apply those. But we don't want to go there, and we don't want to have that debate in some court. There certainly could be an argument made, as you have stated.
Let me follow. Was LCDC's decision on the North Plains appeal based on that? LCDC may not have had standing to stop them from taking whichever lands they want?
Chair Garrard, Representative Greenlich, I don't believe that whether that statute is in effect or not affects the Commission's standing to do that. The Commission was, in that particular case, was basing their decision on the record on the LCDC rules as well. On substantive provisions rather than on standing provisions.
Thank you, sir. No.
I heard the answer. This is are we in work session?
Yes, we are.
This is.
Oh no, we're in. I'm sorry. Okay. On this one, we're in a public testimony. We're not in a work session yet. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
I would, Linda. Do you have? You knew I was going to have to ask an opinion in that it appears that because of this error or mistake that was made, that smaller cities are kind of off the hook. So for those of us that always look at trying to streamline processes, I would be interested in your response to this situation.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Linda Ludwig representing League of Oregon Cities. I guess I need to thank you, Mr. Chair, for the invitation to come up and talk about this bill. We, the League, did not take a position in the Senate on this bill. I have had quite a few calls on this bill acknowledging what it actually does do or where we are today, and I will concur, as you heard from our previous testifiers, that the result of where we are today was an inadvertent error with House Bill 2976 from last session. The League continues not to take a position on this bill.
Representative Greenland.
I'm reading this Section B of the existing 197-296, and all it says as it exists is LCDC may establish the factors under which additional cities are subject to these provisions. It doesn't say they're not subject to them. It says LCDC has the ability to. If this is in English, the Land Conservation and Development Commission may establish a set of factors under which additional cities are subject to the 197-295-314. You take that away, it says they may not establish that. The only thing is this section controls that. Is that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, just an informational item. The last time LCDC did look at establishing a set of factors that would bring additional cities under the 25,000 mark into those requirements, they decided not to do that. And that was last year, I believe. They decided that the 25,000 threshold was ample for at this present time.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, if I, Bob Rindy again, the without this bill, our understanding of what happens is that all these sections that are referenced there do not apply unless LCDC takes a affirmative step to put other cities in.
Yes, that's the way I would read it as well. So the question is, has LCDC done it? That's all it would take is an LCDC action to.
Mr. Chair, I was in agreement. Theoretically, yes, but and we could take that step. We would rather have the legislature affirm that it was your intent that those sections of statute don't apply unless LCDC takes some extraordinary step to put them in, rather than presume that that was your intent. And in fact, I think we all agree as part of the work group 2976 last session that the legislature did not intentionally give LCDC the authority to do that.
I see.
Yes.
You okay?
No, I'm confused, frankly. I mean, I am confused about this. I would like some more notes. This says the LCDC, well, the commission, may establish a set of factors about how the smaller cities relate to this section per se. Am I to understand then, if you take that out, that now all these, otherwise the cities under 25,000 would automatically be covered by all those items? On the basis of some other statute, or
that's correct, Representative Greenlick. In fact, and I think there are representatives from the Housing Division here as well that were involved in the discussion in the early 80s. I really do believe, and I was around when some of those discussions were happening, that the legislature, when they adopted that sweep of statutes requiring cities to provide for needed housing, their intention, because at the time, that was also a requirement of LCDC rules. Why did we put it in statute? It was put in statute, I think, with a clear statement from the legislature that they, that at that time, certainly, the legislature did not intend for cities to escape those responsibilities, and regardless of what LCDC might do. In other words, the commission was, from that point on, prevented from excusing cities from those provisions. And so the actual effect last session is to take away those statutes unless LCDC takes a positive step to put them back in.
The chair feels a little bit like the committee's chasing its own tail here at the moment. Representative Greenlock,
I think I'm getting a little more comfortable. I mean, my understanding is now, and I guess I really do need to clarify this, my understanding is now that right now, that the intent was to have all these, including 197-298, be followed by cities in their creation of an urban growth boundary, whatever the size of the city. And that the intent was to exclude cities under 25,000 from the 20-year build supply if LCDC wanted to exclude them from that provision. This now would give clarity to that by saying LCDC could establish the factors, the 20-year growth supply factors, for cities under 25,000, and takes away any cloud over the question of whether cities under 25,000 are currently under 197-295 to 197-314. And I'm comfortable with that, if that is the interpretation.
Thank you, Bob. Thank you, Linda. We shall close the public hearing on Senate Bill 251A and open a work session on Senate Bill 251A. Representative Doyle?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 251A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Doyle moves Senate Bill 251A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Rosenbaum. Aye. Representative Fremont. Aye. Representative Doyle. Aye. Representative Backerman. Aye. Representative Zahner. Excused. Representative Richardson. Excused. Chair Gerard. Chair votes aye. Senate Bill
251A is moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Do we have a volunteer that would like to be the carrier?
No, I wouldn't volunteer Representative Greenlick on this one. But,
I'll volunteer. I'll try to clear it off beforehand so I know what I'm talking about.
Well, my suggestion would be the consent calendar.
Yeah. I learned my lesson. All right, let's go. Consent calendar.
We will move Senate Bill 251A to the floor with a due pass recommendation and place it on the consent calendar.
I apologize for taking up so much time.
We all read your warning. We will open a work session on House Bill 2909. Committee, we're dealing with the... we'll have the Mr. Kelly tell us about the bill, and we have dash two amendments.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this bill, the original bill, was heard twice before on 27th, 14th. Three times, according to my notes. This amendment before you, which is the dash two amendments to House Bill 2909, replaced the original measure.
Nope.
I don't have that thing.
You have any school? Many members apparently do not have the dash two.
We'll go make copies real quick, Mr. Chair. If you could bring up one of your witnesses that was involved in drafting of the amendments before they get done with their testimony, you will have them in front of you.
Okay. Mr. Chandler.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, John Chandler, Legislative Advocates, in the Oregon Building Industry Association, here on House Bill 2909, the dash two amendments there too. There's a number of folks here in the chair that I think would like to say some things for the record and also to help explain where we are on the bill. And I realize we're in work sessions, so I'd ask your indulgence for that. We brought this bill back to you and got an extension from the speaker to continue working on it. It's the subject matter of the bill is periodic review. It is a very complicated issue. The dash two amendments are not yet right. In fact, there's some fairly major pieces that came out either because of drafting errors, and in Ledge Council, I'm not trying to blame them at all. This is a complicated enough area. Those who are working on the bill turned in a very complicated set of amendments. I think Ledge Council did the best they could at trying to encompass what we were thinking about. There's places where they went further than we thought. There's places where there's simply conflicts that we're still trying to noodle our way through. We would like to move the bill today, and with the commitment, and I'll put this on the record, others of us, they want to testify on this, I believe, that
I wouldn't support the bill for final passage in its current form. It needs more work. It needs to be thought through. A lot of this, as you just saw in the last bill, and Representative Runick, I do not, you didn't need to apologize for taking time. That is a very, it's a complicated thing, trying to pick your way through an area of law such as land use in Oregon, and particularly things such as periodic review and urban growth boundary expansions and whatnot, where every word matters and has been litigated and oftentimes. It's a complicated process, and I apologize, Mr. Chair and members, it's taken us longer than it should have. We've had also had some communication issues. I will state publicly I messed up. I neglected to include one of the significant stakeholders just out of the brain melt on my part. So we've had some internal within our group trying to get people up to speed. What we're trying to do with this bill, though, I'll just remind you, and others will, I think, talk about this as well, what we're trying to do with this is to get the periodic review process working in a way that is both responsive to the budgetary issues facing this agency, the DLCD, this session, and in terms of their staffing, is responsive to the need to get the planning program moving quicker, reviewing local comprehensive plans, making sure that that work is done well, have it function better, but do so in a way that doesn't take the state role out of land use planning, but it keeps that presence there, that gives guidance to local governments, that gives a basis for grant programs and technical assistance to local governments, provides interest groups such as the folks I represent, or 1,000 Friends, or the Farm Bureau, or the next city down the road, or whoever it might be, access to the process so we know what's going on when local governments are going through the plans, and provide focus and direction for the agency on what should be the focus of periodic review, how it should be done, what the working relationship should be, and again, to do so in such a way that it's clear to all the participants and is respectful not only of the interests involved, be it state government, local government, the interest groups, but also of the time it takes and the court cases and policy guidances and everything else over 30 years of land use planning in the state. All that is by way of background, saying I had hoped, and I really had hoped, and it was overly optimistic on my part, to be able to bring back to you a bill that was frankly, closer than this one is. It has always been my practice, though, and for whatever it's worth, that when one, I would prefer to move a big bill out even undone with the commitment to keep working on it, so when we come back to you, it's still a big bill now fixed, than to move out a one-paragraph bill with the commitment we're going to work on it and bring back a 35-page bill. I've never sat on your side of the desk. It's always been my assumption that scenario one is more comforting than scenario two when the one paragraph morphs into a bunch of pages. We are talking with the department. We're talking with the interest groups. Again, I did make a mistake with regard to one of them, the cities, the counties, and all of us, I believe, have a common interest in trying to make the system a better one when we're done. I'm not sure that the Dash 2s do that yet. I think they're much closer than the placeholder bill. I think they're an improvement on the current system, or will be when we're done, and one that we'll be proud of having worked on, and hopefully you'll be proud of having supported, assuming that you do, which I'm going to ask you to. And, Mr. Chair, I'll be glad to take any questions the committee might have. Others, like I say, do want to put some concerns and thoughts on the record, if you don't mind.
Well, as it was the intent was to try to move the Dash 2s today, but I'm wondering if we gave you till next week, John, do you think you could come back and have the Dash 3s or whatever that we would all feel better about it? Or,
Mr. Chairman, I haven't asked the work group that, most of you in the room. I didn't know that was an option, frankly, given the committee schedules. I feel like I'm leading the band here.
Let's
we have a short nod.
Representative Doyle, a recess?
Yeah.
We'll recess the committee for about 5 minutes.
Mr. Chairman?
And allow you to discuss with the work.
Thank you.
Okay. Recess for 5 minutes. being the Committee on Environment and Land Use, and in regards to the...
We don't have a quorum.
Cash.
So here we go.
You do now.
Yeah, we do for a work session.
Oh, yeah, you do now. Yeah. Right? Okay. One, two, you have a quorum.
Yeah. On 2909, we'll give Mr. Chandler and the group till next Thursday, which at this point may be the last meeting of this committee, to see if we can get the Dash 2s to address more of the issues, and if not at that point, then we'll decide what to do with the fate of 2909. So
thank you, sir.
We'll close the work session on 2909. We'll have to we will put off till Tuesday the hearing of Senate Bill. Which one was it that we didn't get?
We've got
516A. We'll hear that on Tuesday. Committee on Environment and Land Use is hereby adjourned.
Are we all done with our...